I'm here today speaking with Anelody Milne and Tiffany Earle on the subject of forms and the 21st century. Tiffany Earle and Anelody Milne are the founders of an exciting new form of education that combines the ideas of mentoring and tutoring in the classics with project learning. They're the creators of the Scholar Projects and of the new Commonwealth Schools. Mrs. Milne is a graduate of George Wythe University and the author of the new Commonwealth School. She speaks across the U.S. and Canada, training parent mentors and educators in the Scholar Projects and the new school form. Mrs. Earle is author of several books, including Intelligro Math, the Thomas Jefferson Portfolio. She has a master's degree in education, and both Mrs. Milne and Mrs. Earle are the founders of Leadership Education Mentoring Institute. Welcome. Thank you for joining our conversation today on the subject of forms. The time is now yours, ladies.
I want to start our lecture today by telling a story about a man named Montesquieu. And Montesquieu was French. He was born in the 16th century. He was born into aristocracy. His name was Charles de Secondat. And he had the opportunity to inherit his uncle's fortune, the big, huge estate. But the catch was, if he wanted to inherit the fortune, he had to become a lawyer because he had to take his uncle's place at Parliament. And so he had to study law. The problem was Charles wanted to be a scientist. And back in the 16th century and early 17th century, science was becoming the big thing. You know, Newton had just come, was getting very popular and studying the astronomy and all that kind of stuff with Galileo was getting really popular. And so he kind of wanted to follow the popular trend. But so he had this choice he had to make when he was 14 years old. He had to make a decision whether he was going to study science or law and inherit his uncle's fortune. So he eventually decided that the lure of the fortune and the money, the property, and the wonderful position in society that he could have was too much for him to deny. So he decided to study law. And at the age of 15 years old, he went to school to study law. He graduated when he was 19, passed the bar exam, and became a barrister on Parliament when he was 19. And when he was 29 years old, his uncle died. And he eventually did take his uncle's place on Parliament and inherited his fortune. And part of that agreement was he had to assume his uncle's name because they wanted the name of Montesquieu to continue its long heritage in the country. So he became known as Montesquieu. And he wrote a book called The Spirit of the Laws. What makes Montesquieu very unique was after he inherited his fortune and he went off to practice law and sit on the Parliament, he had a lot of money to do whatever he wanted to do, and he could take leave of absence whenever he wanted to. And so he decided, well, since he loved science, that he would make government and law his science. And he became a political scientist. And what he did with his money is he began to just travel the world. He traveled all over to study the different governments of the world, the different lands of the world, the different people of the world and their human nature, and what made them who they were. What was really interesting is he studied the people of the warm islands and the warm countries and what kind of people they were and what kind of governments were conducive to them. And he studied the cold countries and regions and the people of the cold countries and what kind of people they were. And he discovered some amazing things applying his scientific nature to politics and government. He discovered that the warm country people, they were a little bit lazy in their lives and they were happy to be dictated to. And so monarchies worked really well for them. But the people in the cold countries were really about getting their business done. You know, the people in the warm countries, They didn't have to work for their food. It was there for them. They didn't have to work for their clothes. They could barely, they had to barely wear any clothes because it was so warm. And so things were much more handed to them, and they were used to that kind of lifestyle. And the people in the cold countries, he discovered that they had to work really hard for their food, and they had to work really hard for their clothes, and they had to work to make their lives happen. And they became lovers of freedom. They wanted to be free to make of themselves what they would be, what they would make of themselves. And those people were much more conducive to a representative kind of government, which was mostly aristocracy back then. But what he discovered scientifically, that there are three categories, he calls them three species, of government. And what we are going to call them today are forms. And the three categories he tells us is one, tyranny, two, a representative or aristocracy, and three, monarchy. There are three different kinds that he put him in. And then he said there were several other forms that fit into those three main categories. Many of us are familiar with the concept of governmental forms. What I'd like to point out today is that there are many forms, not just governmental forms, in every aspect of our lives. And if we become scientists just like Montesquieu did, we can learn to see all the forms around us, and we can begin to see this life in beautiful patterns, beautiful forms, and make choices that we never knew were available to us before.
This leads us to the question, what are forms? Throughout our time together today, we are going to do three things. First of all, we will define forms. Second, we will discuss three reasons to study forms. And in those reasons, we will introduce you to the vital skills necessary to see forms and to think this way. We will also take a look at five categories of forms and their impact. And the fun part is when we take a little self-diagnostic test to see at what level you are able to think and see forms. And hopefully by the end, each of you will be able to define part of your unique purpose in life and mission in terms of which forms you are promoting and living.
Well, I'm thinking to myself, I'm sitting over here thinking forms, like you fill out, you know, I fill out a form to make an application for a bank account or, what is forms? So I'm sure that our audience is asking, or you are, as our audience are asking, what are forms? Let me give you a definition of that. So make sure that you get a piece of paper and pencil out and write this down, because this is a very important definition. Forms are systems that can bring order and structure to our lives. Some are predetermined and some are by default. Some bring order and some are chaotic. Okay, there are two different kinds of forms. There are soft forms and there are hard forms. I want to go back for just a second and talk about those chaotic forms and those predetermined forms. I remember a story that you told me, Tiffany, that I'd like to share. You one time were you were just married, you were just starting your family, and you were having a difficult time figuring out how to make sure you had clean dishes to eat on all the time and that you had clean dishes in the cupboard, because you were never taught in your home a good system or form of getting the dishes done and into the cupboard. And so when by default, you had decided, well, you hadn't decided, it just happened, that when you did the dishes was when the sink was full. Oh, the sink is full. Guess I better do the dishes. But you discovered really soon in your marriage, in your life, that there was a better form, a better way, a better system for getting a clean kitchen and clean dishes in the cupboard.
Absolutely. Understanding systems impacts every aspect of our life.
Yeah. So remember, forms are systems. They're just systems. Just think that in your mind. In the book E-Myth by Michael Gerber, he explains the importance of creating systems. He talks about soft systems and hard systems. And the success of a business hinges on the creation and application of the systems involved. Just as the success of a business hinges upon all thought out systems, so does personal success, family success, cultural success, community success, national success, and government success. In other words, that's life. Life success. Systems and forms create order out of chaos or out of raw material. Hard systems have to do with physical objects and are a certain way of doing something. For instance, putting in a well and piping the water to your house would be a physical system, a hard system. On the other hand, determining what time you wake up each day is a soft system. There's nothing physically grasp onto until just for your routine for the day. It's just an order. There are three reasons to study forms. Number one, forms bring order and structure. Number two, remember, we're writing these things down. Number two, it enables us to actually name problems, which is the first step to solving problems. And number three, it helps us identify our mission.
Reason number one, first, forms are systems that can bring order and structure to our lives. If we don't like the results we are getting, we can change them by changing the way we do things. The way we do things impacts our happiness, our legacy, our prosperity, our security, and our freedom. When the early American founders saw their freedoms, their security, their prosperity, and their happiness declining, they knew that their children's were also declining. They knew something had to change. Jefferson penned it this way in the Declaration of Independence. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. The very form of England's government was destructive to the 13 colonies. It was only by knowing other forms and ways of doing something that gave hope to the 13 colonies. The founders didn't like what they saw happening and luckily knew other ways. Ronald Reagan said, "The challenge of statesmanship is to have the vision to dream of a better, safer world, and the courage, persistence, and patience to turn the dream into reality."
Do you know, Tiffany, as you were reading that quote from the Declaration of Independence, whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it makes me really think that the founders knew what they were talking about. They understood forms. Do you think that's true?
I do. I think that their very educational system taught them how to see this way. And the whole reason, it's almost laughable that we have to have a podcast talking about how to see this way. We weren't brought up this way, but they were. They automatically thought this way. And it was so vital to our freedoms, and that's why we're talking about it, is to actually train our children and our friends and those who are lovers of liberty and freedom to see this way.
I'm asking myself the question, why do you think we don't see this way anymore? What do you think has happened to us? I mean, I'm sure that it's part of our human nature to see in patterns, to see in forms, to see in systems. It's part of our human nature. As I've been training my mind to see this way more and more, I've realized, wow, this is so natural for me. Why haven't I done this my whole life?
You know, you're looking at me really funny. I just know the same story you do. I just know that it took me getting a liberal arts mentor to learn to see like this and to think like this. And it impacted every aspect of my life. It didn't just impact how I viewed government. It impacted the way that I fed my family. I mean, it was one day when I had three kids and I was making three meals every meal because I was feeding me one, I was feeding one of them one, and the other two, my husband, the other one, and I got sick of it. And I was talking to a friend and complaining to her and hearing my own mother's words come to me that I'm going to quit cooking because you don't eat what I cook, right? I could hear her words coming out, and my friend said, "You are crazy. I cannot believe you're fixing three meals every time you sit down to eat." And I said, "Well, what do you do at your house?" And she said, "I make one meal." And I said, "Well, what if they don't like it?" She says, "Then they don't eat." And I was like,
"Oh, novel thought."
I was like, totally aghast. And she trained me how to teach my kids. And now my kids have a taste for 1,000 times more food than their cousins. I mean, they'll eat quinoa, and they'll eat brown rice, and they'll eat white rice, and they'll eat millet, and they won't just eat store-bought sugar put in oatmeal. Do you know what I mean? There's not one thing that they have, but because she taught me. And that's a system, and it's a form. It's a way we do something, and I learned to see that if we don't like the results of something, to bring it back to the way we're doing it. And I've learned how to bring it forward. I've learned how to look at what's going on in the world around me and see, whoa, we make that choice, I know what's going to happen. I mean, it's really about thinking. And I guess that probably the reason why the founders thought that way is they read directly from the classics. They didn't have a whole bunch of textbooks that they read from that gave it to them in a synopsis. They really went to classics because, and we're going to get into this in just a minute, why that actually teaches us how to think this way.
I think it's really interesting that you said you look back, you were able to look back and forward. I was just thinking about the comment that Benjamin Franklin made when he came out of after signing the Constitution, and the people were standing there waiting to see what was going on, and they asked him, "Mr. Franklin, what kind of government have you given us?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." I think he knew so well forms, and he knew that a republic can only be kept
by virtuous people.
By virtuous people.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let's talk about reason number two. Okay, number two, being able to see and compare forms enables us to name the problem. And remember, we talked about naming the problem is the first step in creating a solution to problems.
Right, because the problem wasn't really I was making three meals. The problem was I allowed my kids to eat something and not eat the meal I made. I you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Lots of us will name symptoms and think we're naming the problems and don't know what the real problem is.
Right. Right. And if we see in forms, we can see the real problem,
right,
and not just the symptom of the problem.
Exactly.
And we can really attack the real problem. I'm thinking about the founders once again. You know, as I've been studying the founders, I'm thinking to myself, okay, these little small little taxes, they weren't that big of a deal. Hello, just pay the stamp tax. No big deal. I mean, it's pennies.
But it was what it meant underneath. It wasn't that. It was that they were not represented.
That was the real problem.
Isn't that great? Yeah, the real problem was that it meant that they had the ability to tax them without representation. That was the problem. It wasn't the Stamp Act itself that was the problem that they were going to have to pay that tax. It was the problem that they were being taxed without their consent.
And I think that sometimes this is an attitude with people today, who actually have been taxed by their consent, but it's a different problem. They're paying taxes for welfare programs, and instead of, as the founders had in mind, that they wouldn't be paying taxes for welfare programs, but that all of the giving would be based on our philanthropy. And it takes a virtuous people to be philanthropic. It's a lot easier to be forced to do something when you're not virtuous than to choose to do something.
Right. Well, many people are great problem solvers, but not as many people can discern what the problem is. They have to wait for someone else to define it.
Aristotle said, those who wish to succeed must ask the right preliminary question. And that's found in Aristotle's Metaphysics. The truth is, most problems can be broken down into ineffective or bad forms. It's a simple matter of being able to see them. We'd like to train you today to start seeing in forms. In Roman history, there was a time when violence was becoming rampant. There was very little respect for a person's flesh. By taking a closer look, we saw a correlation between man's violence and their appetite. When man's tongue ran costly and extravagant instead of simple,
they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on rare and costly foods to entertain their neighbors.
And violence was attached to no self-discipline, discipline in finance, in food intake, in war. There was no self-discipline whatsoever. When trying to name a problem, there are essential scholar skills that are needed. These scholar skills make it possible to define the problem by comparing one form to another, without which a person cannot effectively solve problems.
I'd like to mention three skills for helping us learn to see this way. Remember when I talked about how the founders studied the classics and that this study helped them learn to think in a certain manner? The beauty of the classics is that they show and reveal patterns. And the first skill is pattern recognition. A careful study of any classic reveals the inherent strengths and weaknesses, pros and cons, or natural laws surrounding specific forms. There was a study revealed on C-SPAN. The study took three levels of chess players and set up a test to divine the intelligence of the three groups. The beginner level chess players looked at a chessboard with a grouping of chess pieces, and they were asked to replace the chess pieces back onto the board after they were taken off. Only four pieces were replaced correctly. The intermediate level chess players were given the same assignment. Eight pieces were replaced correctly. The advanced level chess players were then tested. These master chess players were able to replace 16 pieces correctly. The test was then changed. The board changed. Chess pieces were placed randomly instead of in recognizable chess patterns. All of these groups were able to replace four pieces correctly. What did this mean? It meant that the way intelligence had previously been measured and the way it seems it should be measured is now being articulated. Intelligence used to be measured by memory, rote. What the chess study showed is that it wasn't memory that made the difference. It was pattern recognition and organizational strategies. The advanced chess players were able to replace 16 chess pieces because they recognized the patterns. They knew more patterns. They understood more patterns. They intrinsically had more choices to make when playing chess because of the pattern recognition. They could also easily recognize these patterns and duplicate them. When the chess pieces were placed randomly on the board, there was no pattern recognition. There was just plain memory, and memory paled in comparison to pattern recognition. Thinking is connecting the dots. It is seeing patterns. Forms and systems are recognized only as we learn to see patterns. This is where my learning took place, was when I had a liberal arts mentor who taught me organizational strategies, taught me how to see the way things are done and what the resulting consequences were. As we see patterns, it is important to annotate and take notes. The very reading of classics engages us in a discussion of various forms. For instance, when we read Tolstoy's War and Peace, we see a story with natural consequences to various choices. We see family forms. We see we see that Tolstoy is literally comparing different ways you can run your family. I mean, you know, if we sat here and discussed the book, we would say, oh, wow, look at how the Rostovs did it. Look at how Peter did it. Look at how, you know, look at how Anatole was going to do it. We see religious forms. We see government forms. We, in this book, War and Peace, we see business forms. I could go on and on. That's the beauty of literature. If it is not bent, then it teaches us the natural consequences to a myriad of forms in a powerful and moving way. Shakespeare is the same. Pick any play, and we will be shown the natural consequences to specific forms. That is the genius of literature. When we read prose, such as Bashiat or Hobbes, we are hearing pros and cons for specific forms, but not in story form. Bashiat denounces socialism. Hobbes promotes commonwealths. Name a classic, and then find a system or form it is denouncing or promoting, or showing inherent strengths and weaknesses. There isn't one that doesn't do it. Every classic is about forms.
Can I tell a story here?
Yes.
I was teaching a Shakespeare class a couple of years ago, and we were in the middle of producing the play, and at the very end of our rehearsals, we were just getting ready to perform the next day, and the young man who was playing Touchstone in As You Like It, he was up there doing his set piece, his in the middle of the play, and he was giving a lecture on lying, the 7 degrees of lying. And Shakespeare says there's the little white lie, and then there's the little lie that says not much. And, you know, he's going through these 7 degrees of lying, and this young man is just rattling off the line. And all of a sudden, in the middle of dress rehearsal, he stops. He freezes. And he's just, you can tell he's thinking, he's something's going on inside of his head. And we're all like, and then he goes on. At the end of the rehearsal, you know, it was a dress rehearsal, so we tried not to stop. But at the end of the rehearsal, I came up and he said, what in the heck was going on there? He said, I just realized Shakespeare was teaching me that there are 7 degrees of lying. And he said, Shakespeare was teaching me a pattern, that one lie leads to another lie, which leads to another lie, which leads to another, which goes in degrees. If we begin to lie once, the little white lie, it just starts our foot on the path of lying.
Wow.
And that's a pattern. It's a form of speech. It's a form of communication. Lying is a form of communication. Shakespeare was trying to teach us.
Right. And Shakespeare's so beautiful because he shows us what happens when we live
yes.
a certain way.
Yeah, because in the story, you find out, you know, what happens to those people who are living that way.
Right. Okay, the second skill that we must have in order to see forms is learning how to judge. Specifically, learning how to find truth. And this is the purpose of often why we try and get an education, is so that we can do this. And my favorite teacher, one of my most favorite teachers who has taught us 4 different ways to learn how to judge truth is C.S. Lewis. And here's what I extrapolated, you know, in reading him, is he does it in 4 ways. He uses 4 things to be able to judge truth. One is his intellect. He uses reason. We have been so blessed with minds and hearts to reason things out with each other and on our own.
Do you know what I think is really interesting about that is I know C.S. Lewis was taught to think in reason and logic, but the one thing that he adds is several other different ways to think. And Plato said, if we all just thought reasonably, we would never choose to do anything that would harm us. But C.S. Lewis shows us that there's not just one way to think and not just one way to do it.
Right, right. I mean, I was watching Star Trek. You know how The Next Generation has come out, and this is totally going to date this. But I went backward and started watching the other Star Treks, and there's one that's all about logic and the hierarchy of reason and just logic, and where does that get you, right? Anyway, let me go on with what C.S. Lewis says. He says another thing that helps him learn how to judge truth is historical evidence, looking at history and opening eyes and seeing consequence. And another one, and this one is valuable. Don't let anybody ever tell you it's not. And that's personal experience. Never discount your personal experience. So many people are taught that what they feel and what they think just must not measure up. It's not true. Personal experience, we have it on purpose. It's what gives us and brings us life. It's why we're here, is to gain it. It's so valuable.
And the thing is, if we combine all of these with our personal experience, that's when life becomes to really become to make sense.
Yes, to not leave any out. And we know the other one is revealed truth. To actually have light descend from the heavens upon our intellects. And C.S. Lewis calls it revelation. I must read this, what he says. This was when he first learned how to think. Okay, because he at home, he could think on that level where he could create with his brother at home, okay? But he hadn't learned to think this way that we're trying to talk about, to see in forms and patterns. And here's what he says. It was his first encounter with his liberal arts mentor who taught him how to think, and his name was Professor Kirk. And this is
they
what...
They called him the Great Knock.
That's right, the Great Knock. This is what C.S. Lewis writes. So he's now... they've met, I think, at the train station.
Yeah, the first time they met.
Yeah.
This is his interchange with the Great Knock.
Yes, and C.S. Lewis is about 15, I'm thinking.
No, I actually think he's a little older than that.
Is he older than that?
Yeah.
Okay. He says, "You are now..." said Kirk, "proceeding along the principal artery between Great and Little Bookham." Okay, so we're now on the main
artery.
Road. We're on the main road. Okay. "I stole a glance at him, and I began to make conversation in the deplorable manner which I had acquired. I said I was surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It was much wilder than I expected." "Stop!" shouted Kirk, with a suddenness that made me jump. "What do you mean by wildness? And what grounds had you for not expecting it?" He was like totally listening to him. I mean, he wasn't used to being listened to by an adult. Really, he wasn't.
Yeah, it's
right?
True.
So he was being listened to, number one.
It took him by surprise.
Totally. He says, "I replied, I don't know what," and still making conversation. As answer after answer was torn to shreds, it at last dawned upon me that he really wanted to know. He was not making conversation, nor joking, nor snubbing me. He wanted to know. I was stung into attempting a real answer. A few passes sufficed to show that I had no clear and distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness, and that insofar as I had any idea at all, wildness was a singularly inept word. "Do you not see, then," concluded the Great Knock, "that your remark was meaningless?"
Wow.
Wow. I mean, I prepared to sulk a little, assuming that the subject would now be dropped. Never was I more mistaken in my life. Having analyzed my terms, Kirk was proceeding to deal with my proposition as a whole. On what had I based, and he pronounced it biased, my expectations about the flora and geology of Surrey? Was it maps or photographs or books? So what was his personal experience? What was his historical experience?
Right.
Well, I mean, he's teaching him, right? What was his reasoning? I could produce none. It had, heaven helped me, never occurred to me that what I called my thoughts needed to be based on anything.
Or biased on
biased
anything.
On anything. Kirk once more drew a conclusion, without the slightest sign of emotion, but equally without the slightest concession to what I thought good manners. "Do you now see, then, that you had no right to have any opinion whatever on the subject?" By this time, our acquaintance had lasted about 3.5 minutes. But the tone set by this first conversation was preserved without a single break during all the years I spent at Bookham. The idea that human beings should exercise their vocal organs for any purpose except that of communicating or discovering truth was to him preposterous. The most casual remark was taken as a summons to disputation. I soon came to note the differing values of his three openings. The loud cry of "Stop!" was flung in to arrest a torrent of verbiage which could not be endured a moment longer. Not because it fretted his patience, he never thought of that, but because it was waiting time, darkening counsel. The hastier and quieter excuse ushered in a correction or distinction merely parenthetical, and betokened that, thus set right, your remark might still, without absurdity, be allowed to reach conclusion. The most encouraging of all was, "I hear you." This meant that your remark was significant and only required refutation. It had risen to the dignity of error. Refutation, when we got so far, always followed the same lines. Had I read this? Had I studied that? Had I any statistical evidence? Had I any evidence in my own experience? And so, to the almost inevitable conclusion, "Do you not see then that you had no right?" etc. Some boys would not have liked it. To me, it was red beef and strong beer.
He was such an exceptional man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
One of my favorite books that he talks about, actually, in the very first pages, these four proofs, is miracles. And he names them off. And you know what I think is really fascinating is the question that is asked is, do miracles really happen? And he disproves personal experience. You can't prove whether miracles happen through personal experience. You can't prove it through logic and reason. You can't prove it through history. And he says the only way you really can prove is through revelation, and you have to be open to that.
Oh, that's I love his ability to think and follow a line of logic. Okay. Through this type of mentoring, C.S. Lewis began to discipline his mind. He learned how to think.
Yeah, and I can imagine if you had a mentor who challenged you like that every day for 2 years, you would really, truly stop to think, and you would start working your mind to think this way. And I really think that it would be wonderful if we had mentors like that in our lives who would stop us and ask us to think before we just blurted things out of our mouths.
Yeah, you're making me think if I can help my children better, then you're making me think. Okay, C.S. Lewis even described popular philosophies of his day, from Neoplatonism to materialism, atheism, agnosticism, Christianity, that he learned to compare and contrast. He then spent his life promoting the form he fell in love with and believed brought human happiness and explained human suffering. Like
so what
Reagan,
you're saying is that he was actually able to see the form for what it was, see the reason behind it, the historicity behind it, and then he was able to compare the forms and then choose.
Yes, and
judge.
Promote. He spent his mission was promoting specific forms, like all of us. Whether by default or on purpose, we spend our life buying into and promoting specific forms. And he did it on purpose. And here's, it's like Reagan. He accepted the challenge of statesmanship, and he dreamed of a better, safer world, being convinced that a particular course of action was the right one. Abraham Lincoln, it was the same way. He studied relentlessly his whole life, disciplining his mind and comparing one form to another.
I really think that about Abraham Lincoln. He was very contemplative. And I don't think that he randomly chose the kind of government he wanted to promote. He knew what he wanted because he was able to see the different forms and the destructive nature of the form of slavery. He knew what it was going to do to our country because he could see the ends of it. Like you said, you can see both sides. You can see the beginning and you can see the end because you can see forms.
Right, right. And Washington, same thing. He was well-read. He had a myriad of experiences to draw upon, so that when his beloved brethren in the army and in his nation offered him kingship and emperorship, he wept. Not for joy, but for sorrow. How could his beloved generals and soldiers not know what they were asking? The very tyranny they had spent years, lives, and monies castrating was now offered to him. How sadly they needed to understand the consequences of the very form they were now promoting. Of course he declined and led our nation to create the freest form in history.
And what's so fascinating about that is it opened a floodgate for freedom to the world. You know, when you're thinking in terms of forms, I'd like to introduce five different categories of forms. There's several different categories that we have of forms, but I want you to get a piece of paper down. A piece of paper and pencil and write this down, because it'll start you thinking in these categories, and then you're going to start, you know, seeing these things all over the place, and you'll find your own categories. So start looking here. There are governmental forms, like the different kinds of governments, representative, democracy. Actually, I do have something to say about governmental forms. Aristotle said that there are three forms of government. He said there are monarchies, aristocracies, and constitutional governments. And he says, and then there are three perversions of those three governments. He said there are tyrannies, which used to be monarchies, and there are oligarchies that used to be aristocracies, and then there are democracies that used to be constitutional governments. I think it's very fascinating if we understand those forms. Wow.
Whoa.
Wow. That's different.
And here we are trying to spread a perverted form
of government.
Okay. Yeah, we better keep going.
Yeah. Okay, so another category is private. These are things like business forms. The e-book is a really good example of that. Community forms. So churches and neighborhoods have their own little communities. Performing arts centers, things like that are community forms. Cultural forms. So pop culture is a cultural form. People who choose to live a specific religious way, say maybe you're a Hasid Jew, that would be a cultural form. And then national forms. We have many different kinds of nations within our government, within our country, sorry. And a good example of that was we have a big Native American nation that lives in our country. We have
several
different kinds of Native American, and that would be a good example of national forms. So these are just five categories you can start thinking in. So what we have to understand is every category has an impact. So if we're thinking of governmental form, and what we have to think of is, what is its impact? Its impact is our security. So if it's a monarchy that we're in, what kind of security are we going to have? If it's a tyranny we're in, what kind of security are we going to have? If it's a democracy, what kind of security are we going to have? That's the impact that it has. National forms impact freedom. So if we have a nation of people who are very tribal, they're only free when they give power to their tribal leaders. And I could go into a lot of detail about that. There's a great book out called Infidel right now. It's talking about how the freedom of Somalia was completely dependent upon the different tribes or clans that were fighting and warring against each other. Okay, so the impact of the cultural forms is our happiness, and the impact of our community forms is our love and our legacy, and the impact of our private forms is our prosperity.
We've listed two out of the three reasons to study forms. First of all, they can bring order and structure to our life. Second of all, learning to think this way helps us to accurately name a problem and to identify how to solve the problem by naming it accurately. Let's go into reason number three. The third reason for learning to think like this and to see forms is because knowing forms helps us identify our personal missions. There is a natural progression of education or phases that a person goes through as he or she learns. A fresh way to look at this natural progression of one's education is in light of a person's unique contribution to humanity and the forms and dreams that one supports. Here is a series of questions to ask yourself to determine the effectiveness of your educational phases. These questions will help you identify your personal mission and what forms you promote.
So, core phase would be the first level, right? For the first phase. To know if you have a healthy core phase, ask the question, to whom have you made your allegiance? Now, we have four choices that you can make. And there may be other choices if you want to think more deeply about this, but there are four choices we're going to give you.
Right. So this is our first question in our diagnostic little test that
right.
you can take.
To whom have you made your allegiance? So here are your choices. Think about this very carefully. Number one, to others. Have you made your allegiance to others?
Like friends or family or spouse? I mean, be really real with yourself. Is your allegiance, or choices you make based on your allegiance to people?
Okay. So the second choice is to self. Have you allegiance to yourself? And that would be when you're, you know, everything that you do is motivated by doing something for yourself. So what do I get out of it? Is the attitude. You know, what's in it for me? And the third choice would be to God. Or to the good things, to the right, to the true. And the fourth choice would be to the evil. To actually, there are people who have their allegiance to Satan, to the adversary. And I think that's very real. I really believe this, that Hitler first was motivated by having his allegiance to himself, and then he quickly moved his allegiance from himself to the adversary, because that's where that leads you. Now, I want you to really be self-honest here, because if you can't honestly answer these questions, then you really can't evaluate your core phase. This is a time when you just, if you really want to know the truth of this, you just have to say to yourself, I need to know the truth. And if your answer is unsatisfactory, then you know where your focus should be. And I really, really want you to think, where is that focus? Because it should be on learning the difference between right and wrong, good and bad, true and false, and determining to live a life full of goodness. If you are determined to live a life full of goodness, then it's obvious where your allegiance should be. It should be to God. I think it's interesting because I have a friend who was having a little bit of struggle in her marriage. And the reason she was having a struggle in her marriage is she had this really strong impression she needed to do certain things in her life. And she felt like it was coming to her from God. And her husband didn't agree with those things. And he was having a hard time grasping or comprehending or even liking the choices she was making. You know, it didn't seem mainstream enough for him, or just wasn't acceptable to him. And we had this conversation. She says, but I know it's what God wants me to do. So my allegiance is to God. I've got to do it. And I said to her, you know, if it's making your husband miserable, I'm having a really hard time believing that that's what God wants you to do. And she started thinking about it. She realized, you know, she didn't have to make those choices to do the things she was doing. She was getting into some herbal things and to, you know, into some more natural healing. And he didn't understand and he didn't like it. And what she realized is she was leaving him out of the conversation. She was leaving him out of the equation. And once she started saying, I'm interested in this. Are you interested in hearing what I'm interested about? I'm interested in. She started including him in the conversation, and then she realized her allegiance was not to God. Her allegiance was to herself and her own interests.
So she was sort of having a superiority thing. I'm right, you're wrong. Sometimes that can be a red flag for us.
Yeah, it can.
Very interesting.
A person's core phase is critical when it comes to a life's mission. and determining which forms a person will support throughout their life. Take Genghis Khan, for example. From a very young age, his allegiance was to himself and to his clan. This allegiance impacted how he led his growing clan to conquer more than half the world. Once again, the question is, to whom have you made your allegiance? You must be honest about this, or you cannot answer this question correctly. And it may be different answers in many different aspects of your life. The one question determines the forms you support and believe in throughout your life. This one question. Mother Teresa made her allegiance to God, and her life was a life of sacrifice and service, bringing endless comfort to those who suffered and the people around her. She supported the form of philanthropy and personal service. This could not have happened the way it did had her allegiance not been what it was. That's the kind of person we want to be.
After core phase is a love of learning phase. And to know if you have had a healthy love of learning phase, and just to share where we're finding some of these phases, is in an article by Oliver and Rachel DeMille about core and love of learning phase and the phases of education. And to know if you have had a healthy love of learning phase, ask these questions. 1. Do you yearn for the change that accompanies knowledge and understanding and application? What good is knowledge if we don't change? What good is understanding if it doesn't lead to a new result?
Exactly.
What good? I mean, the whole purpose is for change. And so this is really the question that captures it. And it's this. Have you felt joy? Let me say it again. Have you felt joy? Do you love the joy enough to go through the pain of learning? The pain of learning is the willingness to change. This is all about us reaching our infinite potential. That's what this is about. And what joy is knowing what you once were and what you are now, and knowing what you can become.
I once heard a quote from a great man that I respect. He said, we are infinitely perfectible. And if we are infinitely perfectible, is that the goal of life? And when we can really embrace the joy that we feel when we change, that's when we truly can start on the path of that perfection.
Right. Right. And I love this quote. It says, the great arcanum, or secret or mystery, that's arcanum, in education consists in forming self-denial. Okay, how many years were you in school, Anelody, and how many times were you taught? The reason you're here is to learn self-denial. Were you ever taught that?
No, I wasn't.
Okay.
My children learn it.
Your children learn. Okay, I love this. Consists in forming self-denial and mastership of the passions. Were you ever told you need to get a control of your passions? That's why we're here. That's why we're reading. That's why we're writing. That's why we're doing. Okay, let me keep reading. Without weakening the vigor or activity of the mind. When one has learned the real meaning of education, this mystery, this secret, that the purpose of education consists in mastering the passions and conforming one's will to the divine mind, then and only then does a person fall in love with learning, because only then is joy felt. If you have seldom felt the sweet joy that accompanies change, then perhaps you need to reevaluate why you learn.
I really like that quote that you talk about, the great secret of education, that George Turnbull says in his book, Liberal Education. It makes me really think about how education today doesn't seem to be the same kind of, it doesn't have the same kind of vision that they used to have during the Scottish Enlightenment back in the 1600s when he wrote that.
Right. In fact, Chancellor of George Wythe University, Oliver DeMille, said, most American students only study really hard in medical, law, or other graduate schools where the focus is on specialized depth, and the time for an excellent broad liberal arts education is past.
So what he's saying is that our time to get that real broad, wonderful, love of learning kind of scholar experience, well, mostly love of learning.
And scholar experience isn't being taken advantage of. And that's where we learn how to think like this. So, that's why we're having this conversation. And here's the third question we ask. Here it is, can you see patterns? Everybody think about this. Can you see patterns and think in terms of forms, discerning natural results? And I'm going to talk about this for a minute. Let's take a look at the three descriptive terms that Oliver DeMille used for scholar face. He had three descriptive terms. One is excellent, the next is broad, and the next is liberal arts. So excellent implies the best classics, the best mentors, the best experiences. It also implies quality of study and of thought. An excellent education means having the best mentor, studying the best classics, and reaching a certain quality of thought.
And so what we're introducing here is a whole different form.
Yeah, actually. It is. It's a different form of education.
Excellence is its form in itself, right?
Right. Exactly. Here's the second term, broad. This term is somehow the most skipped over definition of the progression of one scholar phase than any other term. People want to naturally skip to specialization, which, as your book says, the New Commonwealth School talks about specialization is inherent to the form of slavery. That's mm-hmm. how you can have slavery, is if you are specialized, because right. you cannot think outside of that one thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's how you keep a people in slavery, is to specialize. And the reason is obvious. To gain only specialization, a specialized education, means to be dependent on other specialists for their education. And to be dependent is to be a slave. Broad is exactly what it implies. To have a broad education means that you want knowledge in every and all fields, not just one. You can make connections in more areas, in more ways. In fact, you can't make connections if all you have is a piece of the pie. You can only see patterns and make connections if you have a broad education. So take a look at your own education and ask for just a minute, how many classics have you read in business, in economics, in philosophy, in mathematics? How many thoughts have you had in these areas?
In music.
Right? In music, in literature, in science, in history, in animal care, in cooking, in health, in medicine.
I have to say something here. It's been wonderful having the experience getting a broad liberal arts education for myself, because I'm a musician, actress type, and I haven't really always been interested in politics or government or economics or anything like that. And I've been reading all that kind of stuff now, Bastiat and Aristotle and Locke.
And I remember the first year you went at it.
It was a hard year.
And you just were, excuse the term, you just were a little whiny baby booby butt. you were just saying, I am not a book person. I do not want to read these things. I do not want to have these thoughts, but I will out of duty.
Yeah.
I will for love of my country.
And I will tell you the joy I have felt understanding. Just being able to see what's happening in the world today, I've been able to identify it. It's clear to me, and it's brought me a lot of joy. Oh, I understand that. I see that clearly. And in my core book, in the New Testament, it talks about this is for those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. And I'm beginning to understand what that means now because of my broad liberal arts education.
Wow. And a perfect example of a man who had a broad education is Thomas Jefferson himself. He was a scientist. Why in the world do we limit our children and say, what thing do you want to be? What career path do you want to take? And then label them in that thing? I mean, it's sad when we think about this. Thomas Jefferson was a scientist. He was a historian. He was a writer. He was a businessman. He was a statesman. He was a husband. He was a father. He was many, many things. And that's why he could think.
Yeah.
That's why he could make these connections. So
I think is really interesting is some people say that he may have had Asperger's. He may have been a kind of personality that didn't really interact with a lot of people, but he was so well educated that he had a lot to say when people did meet with him. And look at the amazing impact he had. And yet he was shy.
Let's all have Asperger's then.
Yeah.
I mean, my gosh. You know what? It's crazy. The gifts that we all have, and yeah, we all have things that aren't, that may be our vices. Well, great. Then let's all forgive each other those, right?
Exactly. So the next phase that we're going to talk about is called depth phase. This brings us to the next idea, and in a nutshell, let's take these three questions.
And then add the fourth.
Yes, and add the fourth. To whom have I made my allegiance? Do I love the joy enough to go through the pain of learning? And then, can I see in patterns and think in terms of forms, discerning natural results? And then the fourth, let's go to this next concept, this next idea. Which forms have I chosen to become an expert in? After working as a liberal arts mentor, a mission mentor is in order. Those of you who are looking to go into the next level are able to answer those questions satisfactorily. It's time to have a mission mentor, because the depth phase is a person who chooses one or two areas and goes really, really deep. They learn to their form in which in their chosen field and area they have their passion for, and because of their past broad liberal arts education, they discern the form they think is best and right and true. When gaining depth in one's studies, a person should become a master at something, preparing herself to one day give back. John Adams' story is a perfect example. He did it right, and our children can do it right too. When he was 13 years old, he came home with an announcement that he wanted to quit school and farm like his dad. His father, being the very wise man that he was, gave him a farm job. 2 weeks later, hands blistered, legs sore, feet tired, ditch dug, John Adams wanted to go back to school. This time his father found an incredible mentor. Instead of one who was of the traditional English model of literally beating the education into the students, this new mentor took John Adams through an early segment of scholar phase, preparing him for the broad part. At the age of 15, John Adams was prepared to take the entrance exam at Harvard. He passed and proceeded to study there until his broad liberal arts education was at a close and the graduation came upon him. From there, he knew it was time to choose his profession and go deep. And he had the choice between, he was thinking to himself, I'd either like to go into law or I'd like to become a minister, after he got his broad liberal arts education, and he chose law. He once again found a mentor, and this time a professional mentor, and became a lawyer. The way John Adams did it works. In depth phase, John Adams became really, really good at understanding the law. He was the only American lawyer in Boston willing to represent the British soldiers who were involved in the Boston Massacre. He was the only American lawyer in Boston who supported the form of freedom so much that he knew they deserved the right to a fair trial. And he got a lot of flack for that. But he knew that that is how you preserve freedom. And even when they were at war, he still believed in that. How could he make such a statement, risking his job and his life, because the way he was educated, the way that you do it matters. And that's the form we're talking about. Depth phase is the time to get ready to give back. And we might as well understand forms so that we can do it right.
So once again, which forms have you mastered, and which forms have you become expert in, and where are you giving back? Some people it's art. Some people it's music. Some people it's the form and way they build homes. It's in every aspect of our life. And the final question, this is under the category of mission phase, and this question is, which forms are you supporting by the life you live? It's just simple. I'm going to say it again. Which forms are you promoting by the life that you live? Are you promoting legal plunder? You know, I mean, or whatever. I mean, we can just think about it. We can think about everything that we participate in and really decide what forms we're, because everything's connected to a form.
You know, asking the question what forms we support by the life we live sometimes can be very scary because it can threaten our livelihood. It can threaten our everyday activities. It can threaten our very core of what we believe life is about, asking ourselves that, because basically what it's saying is, if you're supporting the wrong forms, then what are you going to do about that? Are you going to change? And what you're doing in your life is a mission, period. It's a mission. What you're living, what you're impacting is a mission. You get to make that choice. That's what we're here. That's what freedom is all about, is you get to make the choice how you're going to live your life.
Right. I mean, you know, we know that the concept that we're teaching is timeless, and any examples we learn and that we talk about right now for current affairs in 3 years won't be current anymore.
Right.
You know, so we could talk about an issue that's at hand right now to bring this home, and we could bring up what's happening in California with 10,000 farms and how the water's been turned off and what the choice is of us as Americans and of the farmers.
What I think is very interesting is there really is a bottom line form that's being chosen there.
Right. And it's amazing because you think, what are the choices? If those men go out and or those farmers go out and drill wells, they're going to land in jail for the rest of their life. And then I think, what would Gandhi do? He would land himself in jail. Would I do that? Would I have the courage to live satyagraha? To truth speak? Would I have the courage for freedom's sake and for love of my country to sit in jail for the next 50 years because I believed in something? Or, I mean, you know what I mean? This is really real. We can ask these questions all the time. And what's amazing is that after a person becomes an expert because they've studied and because they believe in specific forms, you know, having compared and contrasted several forms in a field of personal passion and subscribing to one form over another, and knowing the inherent strengths and weaknesses of several, the person then promotes the form or course of action that they believe in and feel is right. And, you know, personal example is the only one that I can really take here, you know, for me and you, Anelody, that some of what we do is promote a specific kind of educational form.
Right.
And also a community form of a certain kind of school. And a family form of how parents ought to mentor their children. I mean, every single thing we do aligns itself with specific forms. And we've thought about it very specifically. And never promote a form without looking at historical evidence. Without looking at personal experience. Without reasoning. Without looking into the future and saying what will happen because of this.
I know. It was very difficult for me when I started thinking about forms to make changes in my life to be congruent, to truly be congruent with the truth that I embraced and I believed in. And I had to make some pretty big changes in my life. The first thing I had to do was start reading books, and I didn't like reading books. And so I had to change the way my life looked so that I could spend time reading books. And, I mean, literally, you know, my exercise time looked different. The form I chose for my day, you know, sitting down on the exercise bicycle with a book in my hand, you know,
right.
Became the form of exercise I chose because I had to incorporate it into my life.
Right, because you wanted to learn how to think.
Right.
In more areas than what you'd been exposed to.
Exactly. Can I do a little review really quickly?
Yes.
Would you mind? Okay, so I just want to
review really quickly with us what we've talked about today and some things I really want to give you a challenge in a minute. So the first thing is we give a definition of forms, that it's a structure and a system. And there are predetermined ones, and there are ones that come by default. Some bring order, and some are chaotic. And I want to bring it back to that whole definition, because if we want chaos in our life, then we'll do the default forms. We choose the default forms.
Yeah, by not choosing.
Right. If we want order in our lives, we have to be purposeful and predetermine how we're going to live our lives. And it takes a lot of self-evaluation to do that. So we talked about soft forms and hard forms. A great place to start when you're thinking about forms is to get a planner out and start using a planner to plan a day. What does my day look like so I can be effective? And another great soft system to do is starting to pray. That's a really good form of communication with God. And we talked about the diagnostic tests. It's really important that you go through those diagnostic tests. And we talked about the five categories you can start thinking in and their impacts. And we talked about the four phases that we go through in our education, so that when we're in the scholar phase, that's when we really start thinking in terms of forms. And it's difficult to think in terms of forms if we don't have a core and if we don't have a love of learning. And we need to make that evaluation. I just want to leave you today with a challenge. This is a difficult thing that we've talked about today, and sometimes it can be a little lofty and intellectual. But really, in my opinion, it's what we came to this earth for, is just to be able to think, to be able to have the opportunity for freedom. And the only way that we can embrace that opportunity for freedom is if we really apply the things that we know as truth into our lives. If we think in terms of forms, that application will be a lot easier, and actually the choice and the judgment that we need to have to make that choice is going to be a lot easier too. And I just want to leave you this with this challenge. Just be okay making the hard choices, choosing the forms you're going to support.